Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley, brought to you from the Wyndham Hotel in San Jose. I'm Tom Finella, president of KTEH, the Silicon Valley's public television station, and a member of the Advisory Council for the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley, and your chair for today's event. We'd like to welcome the listeners of KKGO-FM in Los Angeles, one of our more than 225 stations nationwide. It's my pleasure this afternoon to welcome James Risser, director of the John S. Knight Fellowships for Professional Journalism at Stanford University, who will introduce today's speaker. Mr. Risser is a two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. His first Pulitzer Prize was awarded in 1976 for his stories exposing corruption in the U.S. grain exporting industry, and his second Pulitzer was awarded in 1979 for national reporting for a series of articles showing the destructive impact of modern American agriculture on the environment. Previous to coming to Stanford University, Mr. Risser was with the Des Moines Register for 20 years. From 1976 to 1985, he was that newspaper's Washington bureau chief. Ladies and gentlemen, Jim Risser.
Thank you. This afternoon, I am honored to welcome here Jim Lehrer, who is, among other things, the winner of the 1999 National Humanities Medal in Writing and Journalism. All of you are, of course, familiar with his PBS television show, The News Hour with Jim Lehrer, one of the most intelligent and informative programs in the nation. From Watergate to the present day, Mr. Lehrer has covered the important news events in Washington with great knowledge and uncompromising integrity. His strong work ethic and quest for excellence have brought him more than 30 journalistic awards, including the Emmy and the George Foster Peabody Broadcast Award. In today's discussion, Mr. Lehrer will be discussing his new novel, The Special Prisoner. Looking at the lingering effects of morality in war, Mr. Lehrer recounts the story of an American soldier who must come to terms with his imprisonment during World War II. Please join me in welcoming Jim Lehrer.
Thank you very much, Jim. Having Jim Risser and David Kennedy here and their Pulitzer Prizes presented me with a real dilemma a while ago. First of all, Risser gives me a copy of my new book to sign, and I sign it to Jim Risser, my favorite two-time Pulitzer Prize winner. And then David Kennedy gives me a copy of my book to sign, and I figure, now what am I going to say, because they might compare them. So I write to David Kennedy, my favorite Pulitzer Prize winner, and then I put in parentheses, this year. So anyhow, there where we are. I am on a book tour as we speak, and station tour. I have this new novel that Jim Risser mentioned, which I'll talk about in a moment. And I'm also going to where I go on a book situation. I also do go to the public television station, speak to luncheons and dinners and all of that sort of thing. I want you all to know that you should feel grateful that I wasn't here two books ago. That book was a book called White Widow. It was about a Trailways bus driver in the 1950s who had a love affair with one of his passengers, only in his head, with tragic consequences in real life. And it was based on my experiences as a ticket agent for Trailways when I was going to a little junior college in the 1950s on the Texas Gulf Coast, et cetera. And I went coast to coast, public television station to public television station, luncheon to luncheon, corner to corner, proving this by doing this. May I have your attention, please? This is your last call for Continental Trailways, 8:10 p.m., Silverside, air conditioned, through liner to Houston. Now leaving from lane one for Inez, Edna, Ganado, Louise, El Campo, Pierce, Wharton, Hungerford, Kennelton, Beasley, Rosenberg, Richmond, Sugarland, Stafford, Missouri City, and Houston. All aboard. Don't forget your baggage, please. Thank you. Aren't you glad I didn't come here two books ago? It also proves that if you learn something early, you learn it well, and it's totally insignificant, you'll never forget it. This new novel, The Special Prisoner, doesn't have, because you know, when you do go on book tour, you do have to have an act, a gig. It's not enough just to write these books. You got to go out and sell them. It's almost, as I say, it's almost a little bit like going door to door. You know, you say, hi, you know. I'm Jim Lehrer, and I wrote a new book. And they say, well, I'm sorry, you know, I don't have any money. I said, if I give you the money, will you buy the book? You know, it's a... But at anyhow, their special prisoner does not have anything in it that lends itself. No bus calls or anything like that. As Jim said, it is about, it does have a World War II theme, and it talks about revenge and forgetting and forgiveness and that sort of thing. It's the story of a retired Methodist bishop, the retired Methodist bishop of San Antonio, Texas. He's changing airplanes in the Dallas-Fort Worth airport one day, and he sees coming down the gangway a man, a Japanese man he believes was the man who tortured him in a prison camp 50 years before. The Methodist bishop had been a B-29 pilot. He was shot down over Japan in the last days of World War II. He survived. He was damaged physically and otherwise, and he came back and put it all behind him, and he thought he had put it all behind him and discovered differently. He followed the man, I'm sorry to say, not to San Jose, but to San Diego, where there is a modern-day story that begins, and it's interposed with the story of what happened 50 years ago in the prison camp. Now, how did I come to write this book? The seeds for it, in some ways, were planted 50 years ago. I grew up in Wichita, Kansas, where it was one of the major Boeing plants that made the B-29, where it was located. My mother worked on the assembly line. She was a wire cutter. And I grew up thinking the B-29 was the big deal. But that was part of my life, and I went on with my life. Then 4 years ago, a man says to me casually, he said, Jim, did you know that in World War II, the United States, in the form of the 20th Air Force and Hap Arnold, used Bangkok, Thailand, for target practice before they bombed Japan? Because Bangkok was about the same distance as it was from the bases we were using at the time in China and India as it was to Japan, to Tokyo. And Thailand was technically at war with the U.S. because the Japanese had occupied Thailand and forced them to declare war on us. And he said to me, and they destroyed, the U.S. destroyed Bangkok, killed thousands and thousands of people, and nobody ever talked about it and nobody knew about it. And I couldn't get that out of my mind. I wasn't thinking about writing a book. But I decided to find out about it. I'm just curious about it. And maybe it was because my interest in B-29s earlier. But anyhow, I did find out about it. I found out, yes, there was one such raid, 100 or so B-29s. And they didn't destroy hardly any of the city because the bombing was so inaccurate because they flew from, say, they bombed from such a high altitude. About 1,000 people were killed, and that was it. But in the process of finding that out, I got hung up on these young kids who were flying those B-29s. They were all 18, 19, 20 years old. I got interested in the training they went through, how they got selected, how they took care of themselves in combat and elsewhere. And then I got interested in the people on the ground, the Japanese civilians who had to look up every night and see those big silver planes coming, literally dropping fire on them. They were dropping incendiary bombs. There were more Japanese civilians killed by the firebombing of the Japanese cities than were killed at Hiroshima and Nagasaki combined. And I got interested in all of this. And then I got interested I read somewhere about the statistics of the prisoners, the U.S. flyers who were taken prisoners. They were designated special prisoners, and that's where this title comes from. It was as a result of the Doolittle Raid in 1942. Some of you have either remembered or read about it. It was a psychological thing. An American general, he was then a colonel, Jimmy Doolittle, mounted a bombing raid of Tokyo off of an aircraft carrier in 1942. It enraged the Japanese. They declared that all from that day on, every American flyer who was taken prisoner was a special prisoner and is a war criminal and could be similarly executed without process, et cetera, brutalized in captivity, et cetera. Anyway, I got interested in that. I started reading diaries of some of the prisoners and also started reading the recollections and the versions from the Japanese and why and put all this together and all got caught up in my head, and I decided to write this novel, The Special Prisoner. In the process, I made a lot of discoveries. I discovered that we demonized the Japanese in a propaganda way beyond all belief. They were, you know, little yellow demons, barbarians. They were demonizing us as the big white demons, barbarians, who wanted to completely dominate all of Asia, including Japan. I found out about the cultural differences, a lot of the things that were dismissed as brutality on both sides. Some of it came out of just basic cultural differences. For instance, all Japanese people were taught at the time that anybody who surrenders in warfare is subhuman. So it's just a cultural thing. And of course, we are taught just the opposite, that if somebody is taken prisoner, they should be taken care of, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, in other words, they should not be brutalized and should not be mistreated. Anyhow, all of this came together, and the Special Prisoner is the result, and I'm not going to tell you any more about it. I know I stand here for all of you today as the TV guy who also writes books. Someday I wish it might, someday, maybe it'll go the other way, that I will be the novelist who also does television. You should know, just for the record here, that I've been writing fiction as long as I've been doing journalism. Not at the same time. Don't read anything into that, please. I'm from the Hemingway generation. Hemingway said, if you want to write fiction, get a job on a newspaper. It'll force you to deal with the English language in some semi-coherent way on a regular basis. It will keep bread on the table, and if you pay attention, it'll give you characters and situations and stories to write about as a fiction writer. Well, I bought into that hook, line, and sinker. I was a sophomore in high school in South Texas, a place called Beaumont. A couple of three things came together at one time. I wanted to be a professional baseball player. I wanted to play shortstop for the Brooklyn Dodgers. Problem with that is I wasn't a very good baseball player. But there were sports writers that came to our games, and I thought, hey, I could be one of those guys, and I could go to the games for the rest of my life and get paid for it. At the same time, and I'm sure all of you have stories like this in your personal history, an English teacher, I had written a theme on, they called them themes then, I don't know what they call them now, I'd written a theme on Charles Dickens' Tale of Two Cities, and I'd gotten an A on the paper, and the teacher had written in the left-hand corner, Jimmy, you are a very good writer. All of this came together. I decided that's what I was going to be. I told my mother and dad, I am going to be a writer. And I was going to be a newspaper man, and I was going to be a writer of fiction. And I was 16, 17 years old at the time, and now I stand here in San Jose, California, and I am a writer of fiction, and I am a journalist. So I know I'm a rare breed, somebody who made a decision at that. Fortunately, I didn't decide I wanted to be a professional wrestler or a brain surgeon or something else. I did decide to do things that I could, in fact, end up doing. This book is important to me, but there's another major event in my life that is about to happen this year, and that's the 25th anniversary of our program on public broadcasting. It did begin 25 years ago this October, it's coming October, had the worst title in the history of television. It was called the Robert McNeil Report. If you can imagine a worse name for a television program, I sure as hell can't. And after about 6 months, my mother intervened and it became the McNeil Lair Report. We did one story a night. Several of you have said to me earlier today that you've been watching us from the beginning. Well, then if you watched us from the beginning, you know in the early days we did one story a night. And some of you may remember some of those one stories. One night, early on, because McNeil had once owned a house in Portugal, we did 30 minutes on some Portuguese elections. And McNeil was sick that night, and I had to run the entire discussion. I'd never been to Portugal, barely. I just knew that's where Christopher Columbus came from, and that was about it. Anyhow, about 12 minutes into the program, this 30-minute program, I realized that I had just told the American people more than they were going to ever want to know about these elections. And then 16 minutes in, I realized I had now told the Portuguese people more than they would ever want to know. We had a lot of problems. We did a program one time, 30 minutes, on the differences between freshly made potato chips and those in cans called Pringles. I kid you not. We did a program one night on tomatoes, those that are grown kind of in bus depots, you know, hothouse places, and those that are grown fresh outdoors. And that was one of our really great moments in McNeil era history, because McNeil, thank God this was happened to McNeil, he had the world's greatest expert on tomatoes sitting in front of him live in the studio with a cutting board and a knife. And we had, to make it fair and honest, we had sent some of our reporters out on the streets of New York to buy tomatoes. And her deal was she was going to be able to tell the difference in quality between those that were fresh or whatever, and those that were kind of phony. And she cut into the phony one, and she cut into the fresh one. She took a bite of each, and this was all live. And she says, "You know something? I can't tell any difference." One other quick story from those days. It's my favorite story. Fortunately, this also happened to McNeil. A grain elevator had exploded. And we did a 30 minutes on grain elevator safety. And we again found the world's greatest expert on grain elevator. No offense, David Kennedy, but it was a college professor from somewhere. And we flew to New York. McNeil was interviewing him. He said, "Okay, professor, you know, a grain elevator has exploded today in Georgia. How many other grain elevators?" This guy had just finished this massive report on grain elevators in America. And he said, "How many other grain elevators are out there about to explode?" And the professor, having read your report, professor, I think the figure is 10,433. Is that right? You know, the question, of course, is what do we do about it? What do we do about it, professor? You know, this guy, I won't go on. This guy froze. He never said a word. Fortunately, this happened early in our days, and it was the greatest lesson we've ever learned. You better do your homework, because you may have to do the answers and the questions. It was really something. This guy never uttered a word, and all the information got out, I swear. 1983, we went to an hour, and when we went to an hour, our entire mandate changed, our entire concept changed. When we were a half hour, our whole deal was that we were a supplement to everybody else. In other words, you watch a nightly news program, and then you come to us for one story in depth. But when we went to an hour, we said, okay, you don't have to watch anybody but us. We were no longer a supplement. We were an alternative. And we give the headlines at the top, and then we do two or three other stories in depth. Robert McNeil, who is still my best friend and partner, retired. It will be 5 years this coming October, and we're still at it. We have made some changes since Robin retired. Those of you who watch the program regularly know what they are. We, of course, added senior correspondents, most recently Ray Suarez and Gwen Ifill. I understand Gwen was just at Stanford speaking, and several of you were there and mentioned that to me. They're terrific people, both of them, and terrific journalists. Then with Margaret Warner and Elizabeth Farnsworth, I think they give us a very strong sub-anchor team. In fact, I probably wouldn't be on book tour if I didn't feel that way. I left Washington on Sunday without a trace of guilt, and because I knew things were going to be in good hands. We've also added a media unit under Terry Smith. My feeling about that and why we've done that, and I'm going to talk more about the media in a moment, is that I feel that how we get information, you all are right here in Silicon Valley, you're part of this, it's not just media in the old press critic sense, but how we get information in this country, I think, is a major, major story, and it needs to be seen as a story and reported on as a story, and that's what Terrence Smith, who was with CBS and with the New York Times before that, and the fact is, y'all remember Red Smith used to write sports for the New York Times and New York Herald Tribune. Well, Terry is one of his sons. And we have a health care unit under Susan Dentzer. That's because we all feel very strongly that that is also one of the major ongoing stories in this country that has not been resolved. We still don't know how we're going to do this, which is to bring high-quality medical care, health care, to everybody. And it's a political story and a social story as well as a quote, health and medical story. We have even added poetry to the program since McNeil left through the work of Robert Pinsky, the poet laureate of the United States. I don't know if you all have seen, those of you who are regular viewers have seen these My Favorite Poem thing that he did with it for the Library of Congress. And those who have not seen it, he did a project and he just asked people out in the country what was your favorite poem. And he got 18,000 responses. And they contacted 50 of these folks. This wasn't the favorite poem you've ever written or anything, just a favorite poem that somebody else wrote that's been important in your lives. Got 18,000 responses. They went out and taped 50 of these people explaining, 50 Americans explaining why this poem was so important, and then got them to recite it. Well, we've taken... And then he called one of our senior producers and said, hey, would you all be interested in looking at these things and possibly running them? And so anyhow, it's great glory to be on a program where we can do that kind of thing. And I looked down and said, yeah, let's do it. Well, the response has been we plan to run maybe three or four. Well, the response has been so terrific. The first one was a guy works outside Boston as a lineman, and it was a Whitman poem. And the response has just been terrific. Anyhow, we may run them for the rest of the life of the program, I'll tell you. I mean, it's been a terrific thing. But the one thing, we have made our changes, but the one thing that it will never change, and that is the basic philosophy of our journalism. The kind of journalism we practice will never change. And what kind of journalism is that? Well, I was asked this recently by a seminar on media and journalism at Aspen. Asked me, along with some other people, I wasn't the only one, what if I had any personal guidelines that I used in my practice of journalism. Let me read you in part what I sent them. These are my guidelines. Do nothing I cannot defend. Cover, write, and present every story with the care I would want if the story were about me. Assume there is at least one other side or version to every story. Assume the viewer is as smart and caring and as good a person as I am. Assume the same about all people on whom I report. Assume personal lives are a private matter until a legitimate turn in the story absolutely mandates otherwise. Carefully separate opinion and analysis from straight news stories and clearly label everything. Do not use anonymous sources or blind quotes except on rare and monumental occasions. No one should ever be allowed to attack another anonymously. And finally, I am not in the entertainment business. Those are my guidelines. Now, the hard part, the sermon. The fact of the matter is, those guidelines seem very simple, don't they? And they seem very basic and very old-fashioned and very, so what's the big deal? Well, the big deal, I'm sorry to say, from my perspective, you may or may not agree with me on this, Jim may or may not agree with me on this, there are not very many places right now in American journalism when you can adhere to those old-fashioned guidelines. And I am fortunate, and the people who work with me are fortunate, that we can do this on the NewsHour in public broadcasting. Because that noise you hear out there, and of course you don't hear that here in San Jose, but the other people in the country hear rain and thunder. It's not rain and thunder. It's the great institution, once great institution of journalism, crashing right behind us. It is, I'm sure you know this, but we practitioners of journalism and the public opinion polls are right down there. I don't want to offend anybody present here, but we're right down there with the lawyers and the child pornographers. Clearly, I'm all right there. And I understand why. One of them is my point about not being in the entertainment business. Some of the folks in our business have decided that in order to attract audience, to attract readers, they must, in addition to being to practicing journalism, they must also entertain. Garrison Keillor made a speech in Washington a few years ago to a big dinner of radio and TV journalists and pseudo-journalists, and he warned about the danger of trying to be fascinating rather than just informing. And here's what he said. When you slip into the field of entertainment, then you will be expected to be fascinating. This is going to shorten your careers. Nobody can be fascinating for long, but people can be accurate and responsible for an entire career. End quote. Amen. Another problem, and I would also endorse the lament recently of a former editor of the Chicago Tribune, Jim Squires, and he wrote the following. News events spawn new celebrities who show up at a later event with a microphone, pretending to practice the craft of journalism. Actors, comedians, politicians, lawyers, infamous criminals, and some who fit all five categories now regularly masquerade as reporters on newscasts and talk shows. Watergate burglar G. Gordon Liddy and Clinton White House political advisor George Stephanopoulos are both now widely considered to be journalists. Former Nixon speechwriter Patrick Buchanan and civil rights activist Jesse Jackson go from being story subject one month to story teller the next. Lawyer Johnny Cochran may be on television standing beside a famous defendant one day and on another interviewing the same defendant from behind an anchor desk. Worse, many of the people signing the paychecks for these pretenders and making the programming decisions can't see any difference between real news and celebrity news programming. They think that having been celebrated in one news event qualifies someone to cover another. It never crosses their minds that their position in charge of news organizations carries with it a responsibility to protect and preserve the values of real journalism, end quote. My own personal analysis of why we are losing, I've lost a lot of our credibility, and why we are in trouble, in addition to those two points that Keeler and Jim Squires make, and there could be many others. My own is this blurring of the lines between opinion, analysis, and straight news reporting. When I began in this business 40 years ago, one group of people said, here's what happened. Another group of people said, here's what it means. And another group of people said, here's what I think about it, and here's what we think you should think about it. And they were not the same people. There were reporters and editors who did this. The analyzers were carefully labeled experts, et cetera, who did the analyzing. And then the opinion people were the columnists, the editorial writers, the editorial page editors, et cetera. That was the old way. What has happened now, and every reader and every viewer knew the difference. It was part of the contract. You picked up your local newspaper or you watched your nightly newscast, you knew the difference. It was part of the deal. Now, somehow, right before our very eyes and ears, all of that has changed, and these lines have become blurred. And I think the public is very confused about it, and I think it's hurt those of us who practice journalism. They see network reporters giving a straight news report on a newscast and then on a Sunday program giving their opinions about about that very story they had covered so supposedly as a straight reporter. They see straight news anchor people going on radio programs giving their opinions about stories that they've been reporting. On the print side, it's now a big deal, and I know Jim Risser knows this, and the big major newspapers and news magazines, part of the job description now is you got to be ready to go on television. That's good for your career. It's good for our publication. These cable news networks have got a lot of airtime to fill. You get out there and do your part. And so, and the questions that are asked are not straight news reporting questions. A lot of them are about it. It all came to a fore it began during OJ, and it really came during the Clinton Lewinsky matter, where, you know, it was, you know, some of those things were Lewinsky all day, all night, 24 hours a day, and there were a lot of straight news reporters who were asked their opinions, and unfortunately they gave them, and the lines got continued to blur and to blur. And I think this is a serious problem in our business, and I've been ranting and raving about it wherever I can, and I plan to continue to do so. And now, that's the end of that sermon. And now I want to start taking your questions and comments. Before I do, I want to tell you how grateful you should be that I didn't come here last year. Last year's book was called Purple Dots, and it had a scene in it where two CIA agents were sent to ascertain whether or not a Latin American diplomat who had been assigned to Moscow, this was in the 1970s, been assigned to Moscow and had volunteered to spy for the United States while he was in Moscow, whether he was for real, because they thought it might be a setup. And he said the reason he wanted to spy for the U.S. is because he grew up in the U.S. He lived here in the 40s as a kid. So these two CIA guys were sent to find out if he was real. They went to interview him. They asked him all kinds of questions. They began to ask him questions about what was like in the United States in the 1940s. And they got to this question. Did you listen to the radio when you were a little boy in the States in the 40s? Yes, sir. What radio programs did you listen to? He said, well, I listened to Hop Harrigan, Jack Armstrong, the All-American Boy, Captain Midnight, Tom Mix. Who sponsored Tom Mix? Shredded Ralston. You remember the song? The spy, would-be spy, stands up and sings, Shredded Ralston for your breakfast starts the day out shining bright. Oh. Now, I will not finish that song. But if I'd been here last year, I would have. I'd have sung the whole thing for you because that was my acting gig for last time. Anyhow, you're off the hook. Now, I would, David Kennedy is going to, you're going to come and you're going to interview, what are you going to, you're going to introduce David Kennedy. Okay, great. Okay.
Thank you very much, Jim Lehrer, for your remarks here today about your new book and about important issues in journalism. Now, I'd like to introduce David Kennedy, who will handle our question and answer period. Dr. Kennedy is the Donald J. McLaughlin Professor of History at Stanford University and a most recent recipient of the Pulitzer Prize for his book, Freedom from Fear. As an academic scholar, his research combines economic and cultural analysis with social and political history. His numerous publications reflect his interdisciplinary training in American studies, combining those fields of history, literature, and economics. His new book, Freedom from Fear, The American People in Depression and War, draws some compelling insights in one of the most turbulent political and economic times in U.S. history, including the periods of the Great Depression and World War II. David Kennedy.
Thank you, Jim Risser, for that generous introduction. Mr. Lehrer, we have a number of questions for you from our audience. They span a range of subjects having to do with your novel, The Special Prisoner, also about the craft of journalism, and about some of the issues that have been the subject of your recent reporting. But to begin, POWs and veterans of World War II, such as the subject of your book, seem to have come out of the war less emotionally and psychologically scarred than POWs and veterans of Vietnam. Why do you think that is?
Well, I'm not sure they came out less scarred. I think they came out less willing or with fewer invitations to talk about it when they came out. I think the situation was such, my reading of it, and the my recollection at the time and then the research that I did for the book, I came to the conclusion that the horrors of World War II were just like the horrors of any war. And the people who went through them just didn't want to talk about it. And they wanted to get on with their lives. And remember, when you serve in a great war, then you have to act like it was a great war. And you have to get on with it. And these guys never had, they were never drawn out. They weren't, didn't want to do it on their own. And so they, I mean, one of the things, the success, for instance, of Tom Brokaw's book, The Greatest Generation, it's mostly the children and the grandchildren, the World War II veterans who are so enthralled with these books because their fathers never talked about it. And the fathers of Vietnam, I'm a Korean War era. I mean, I wasn't in the Korean War. I went in the service during the Vietnam War. I mean, the Korean War, but the war was over by the time I actually went on active duty. But I mean, the Korean War was kind of the beginning of the end of glory an invitation to kind of talk about it all. But I think it just had to do with the times, but the horrors were enormous. At least the ones I read about and have heard about in preparing this book.
Thank you. The next question is actually a two-part question. The first part is, how do you possibly find time to write? And who are your favorite novelists, historical or otherwise?
The time to write thing is I had a heart attack 17 years ago, and it may be the best blessing in disguise that ever happened to me. And recovering from that heart attack, I realized I wanted to do what I wanted to do, and I didn't want to do what I didn't want to do for how much longer I had on this earth. And that meant get back to my fiction writing, which I had put to the side because I found that I couldn't have a personal life. I had a family, 3 daughters, and I also had a day job. And I couldn't do my writing, too, so I had to give up one of the 3. I didn't want to get rid of the family. I had to work, so I didn't write for a while. But when I was recovering from the heart attack, I realized I had to get back to my writing. So in order to do that, I had to quit doing the things that I didn't want to do. And once I did that, and a good doctor said, you know, just make a list of everything you do that takes time and energy and causes anxiety in your life. And I did. He said, now quit doing half of them. So I did, and suddenly I had plenty of time. And the writing specifically is an integral part of my life. Jim Risser will understand this. People who are in daily journalism for any period of time and who thrive on it are people who can write underwater, hungover, hanging by their thumbs at 5 in the morning. I'm one of those. It isn't a special, you know, if I waited for the wind to be right and to have a long period of time before I wrote, I would never write. Because I never have. The wind is never right, and I never have a long period of time. But I write every day. I do something on one of my fiction things every, whether it's just taking notes or editing. I have a laptop. I've worked on this book tour. I'm working on another book. It's just something I do every day. I get up very early in the morning, also the carryover from the heart attack. Only good habit I've ever developed is I take a nap every day for an hour. Every day, literally every day when I'm working. So that means I still have energy at the end of the day. I had been doing this television program before that where I had to be at my best at the end of the day after working all day, and it was all phony energy. But now with a nap, I still have some real energy left at the end of the day, and also then I can write. Another reason I write is my wife is a novelist, so we speak the same psychic language. One of us is in a funk because of this or that. In our writing, we understand each other. And that helps. And it's just extremely important to me. So I found I can find time to do things that are really important to me.
And your favorite novelist, historical or otherwise?
Favorite novelist. I think if I had to name one, it would be Georges Simenon, the Belgian writer who was actually lived in France. He wrote 500 novels. Some of them were about an inspector, Paris inspector, Maigret. I defy anybody who's interested in writing fiction to find a better model for. I mean, you can read a sentence of Simenon where he, one sentence describing a hot day in Paris, and you'll sweat, I promise you.
Next question is, it has been argued that in the era of the Internet, the American public has the attention span of a gnat. Do you agree that this has affected the content of television news, and has it had any effect on your program?
Well, I don't know about the attention span thing. I'm not an expert on that. I know that it has not affected the content of our program. We are still... I still believe that the people there are people, maybe not everybody, but there are people in this country who care about certain issues, and they want to know more. And our audience is held. I mean, the fact of the matter is, when we're on the air in the evening, our audience is larger than CNBC's, MSNBC's, CNN's, and Fox News channels all combined. And when we started, there were a lot of people said, "Are you kidding me? Nobody's going to watch it. This was 25 years. Nobody's going to watch a program that does one story a night. I mean, a serious news program. Forget it." Which was great because that kept the expectations very low. And but we're still doing it 25 years later. So my experience is, oh, sure, there are people with short attention spans. Sure, there are people who don't care. But there are people with long attention spans, and there are people who do care, and they deserve to have a program like ours.
Well, here's a question that grows out of the subject matter of your book, The Special Prisoner, which depicts a lot of brutality in the Japanese POW camps inflicted on American flyers. The question is, recently there has been new publicity about the rape of Nanking. Do you feel in general that the Japanese were no more brutal than the Allied troops?
You know, I'm going to have to leave that to others to judge that. I read an awful lot, and I read both sides. There are a lot of things in fact, the novel goes into this in a way. What is it? Is it more brutal to brutalize somebody in a prison camp than it is to drop fire on you and in your home? I mean, everybody has their own answer to that. And my answer is no more valid than anybody else's. I think the thing that I discovered and the thing that I believe is that in times of war, properly motivated, good people can do brutal things. And those people can be Japanese, they can be Americans, they can be British, they can be Iranian, they can be Somalian, they can be anything. And none of us knows, sitting here or anywhere else, exactly where our limits are. Because when you have a justifiable cause, or if you feel like it's in self-defense, you could suddenly do something like set a hut on fire in Vietnam. Those were good Americans, good American boys who did that. Oh my God, what did I just do? Something I would never have thought I could ever do that. And I came out of my experience in writing this book convinced that all of us better be very, very careful about broad generalities about what we would do, what we wouldn't do, when properly motivated and properly triggered. I know that sounds very ambiguous, but we are talking about the ultimate ambiguity, in my opinion.
Your answer reminds me of a remark, I believe, of Karl Polanyi's, who said something to the effect that the Holocaust revealed the human beast in its Nazi form. But it can take on many forms. Here's a question again about the craft of journalism. As a working journalist yourself, which media outlets do you look to for information or inspiration, magazines, newspapers, and so on?
Well, I'm a news person. I'm a professional news person, so that makes me a news junkie, and I can get away with it. Let me be specific, though. Every day at my house in Washington, I delivered the Washington Post, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal. I read those usually before I go to work. Every week, once a week, obviously, the Time, Newsweek, U.S. News and Report, the Weekly Standard, the New Yorker are all delivered to my house. Not because I subscribe to those other three. I don't subscribe to these. It's an interesting thing. You'll be there. It's a PR thing. You know, that's the new PR thing. These print magazines, they want TV people like me to read their magazines. So there's a master list. It's called a VIP press list, and somebody comes and leaves it on my front porch. I never thought I'd get the New Yorker that way, I'll tell you. I read those magazines. We have a system in the NewsHour where We take about in addition to those newspapers, we take another 7 or 8 daily newspapers and we change them regularly. So we will, keep, it won't be just the Cleveland Plain Dealer all the time or the Los Angeles Times, the Philadelphia Inquirer, those come to the office all the time. USA Today, the Washington Times, I'm trying to think of, but those are regular publications that are right there in the newsroom. And I don't read those. I don't read every one. I'm not suggesting to you that I read those cover to cover. But we have – I read the hotline every day. There's something called the political hotline. There's a service in Washington owned now by the National Journal, and they glean every newspaper in the country, every newscast in the country, and put together political news every 24 hours. It's fun reading because they – take shots at people and just stuff, and it goes all over the country. And their scope is all over the country. The electronic aspect of this makes it possible to do things that you could never do before. We also have a terrific research department, and they, in addition to our beat reporters, they flag additional stories for me to read and for things like other things. I'm trying to think of other publications that I occasionally look at. The New Republic. I get it. I look at American Prospect, which is a liberal publication published in Cambridge as a counter to the Weekly Standard. And National Review comes to our office. All of these things are anyhow, I feel that my job, and it's a great thing, I mean, to be able to read all this stuff all the time. And I'm looking at the wires all day. And I also have the virtue of having a terrific staff that's monitoring the news with me. As far as additional outside reading, I read every word, every book that has been written by David Kennedy, a distinguished professor, historian who recently won the Pulitzer Prize. I found that his book that won the Pulitzer Prize, I only had one problem with the book. It was 900 pages, weighed 4 tons. It's equivalent to 5 of mine. So, one of the great things about my job is that I must stay up on things. I must know certain things. It isn't an option, because the bottom line is I really do not want to make a fool of myself on national television.
But you're still not above living dangerously, I noticed. Well, this question begins as a Valentine and then takes on a little different character. Thanks for the news hour. Excellent! Exclamation point. Could you address the protests against the IMF and the World Bank? Why doesn't anyone interview some of the protesters?
I love questions like that. That was clearly written by somebody who does not watch the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer on PBS. We interviewed many of the protesters. We had the leaders on, gave them equal time with the president of the World Bank and the head of the IMF. We interviewed the people who were there on the street. So I don't know why those other people didn't interview the protesters, because we certainly did. And thank you very much for those kind words about the NewsHour.
You alluded to working in a bus station when you were young, and you're known to have quite a collection of bus memorabilia. Can you please tell us about this and the time it takes you back to?
It is with great pride, ladies and gentlemen, that I tell you things a thing you probably did not know. I am the world's number one collector of bus drivers' cap badges. I am also the world's leading collector of bus depot signs. I am the second or third leading collector of antique toy buses. I grew up in the bus business. My dad was in the bus business. As I said, I worked in a bus depot myself. When my dad died in 1970, I was going through some stuff, and I found some old cast iron buses that I'd had, my brother and I had had, and I started thinking, oh, well, and I started collecting other things. And before you knew it, I picked up an old porcelain sign, an old Greyhound, Pickwick Greyhound Depot sign, and an old kind of junk store. Then I picked up a Greyhound dog that had come off the side of a bus. Then I found a cap badge. We had a little bus company in Kansas in the 1940s. It opened for business in June 1946 and went bankrupt in July 1947. It's a terrible story for my father because he had to file bankruptcy, and at a time when it was considered not a very good thing to do. It's not like now. But it was a great... It was a great adventure for me. I was 12 years old, and for my brother. But in fact, I wrote a book about it that one year, the bus line, called We Were Dreamers. But anyhow, I have now, to get to the point, I have probably 225 various kinds of bus depot signs. When I say bus depot signs, I mean old porcelain enameled signs that would say, well, Peerless Stages, or Gibson Lines or something. These are companies that are from here in Northern California, as well as Pacific Greyhound and West Coast Railways and some of those. And the cab badges are the same. I have about 300 of those. And I also, my pride and joy is that I have a real bus, a 1946 flexible clipper that I have completely restored. And I don't know. You ask the question, I'm giving you an answer. Don't look at me like I'm crazy, Judge. And this bus is more than just a routine bus. If my dad had been able to buy this model, et cetera, just like this, in 1946, our bus line probably would not have gone broke because we had old rundown buses. It had been worn out in World War II, and all our money went... We had passengers, but the money went directly from them to a mechanic or to a parts supply outfit. And anyhow, I found this bus in a garage. A guy had it down in Virginia, and I bought it. It's in pristine condition and restored it, and I have it painted in the colors of my dad's bus company, Kansas Central Lines. I have it painted on the side. I have the names of the towns: Valley Center, Sedgwick, Newton, North Newton, Gossel, Lehigh, Hillsboro, Canton, Galba, and McPherson across the top on either side. And I am a bus nut. And why do I do this? I don't know. Myself, a friend of mine has analyzed this, is that maybe this is my way of saying to myself and to anybody else who's interested that what my dad does was very important. I don't know. But I do all my writing when I'm at home, and I have a what we call a bus room, which is a downstairs room in the basement, where I have my computer and I have all these bus depot signs, and it's like being a child again, and that's what it does. It brings me back to being a kid, and it's great, great fun.
Well, I'd like to take you back to the subject matter of this fascinating novel, The Special Prisoner, if I might. It's a book that puts me in mind of a work by your fellow journalist, Ian Baruma, a book of his called The Wages of Guilt, which is about how Germany and Japan, respectively, have dealt with their memories of World War II. And it's a book that can be summarized, I suppose, in a sentence that does some injustice to the nuance of Baruma's account, but basically his argument is that Germany remembers too much and Japan remembers too little. And I suppose we might add another example of a country in our own time which is trying to grapple with its own memories of its troubled past, which is South Africa and its Reconciliation Commission. But I wonder if you might just ruminate a little on the process of memory and reconciliation in these respective countries, some of which figure so prominently in your novel.
Well, I was very interested in that, David, but I did not. I only did one part of the equation. I did not attempt to compare what the Japanese did with what the Germans, how Germany dealt with it. I did compare in terms of the treatment of prisoners of war, but not in terms of the forgetting. There's a terrific book. The title I do not remember. About the last few months in Japan, the government of Japan toward the end of the war. Fascinating, the internal politics and the personalities that were were involved there. But we've got to remember two things about the differences between the way Japan handled post-war and the way Germany handled post-war. First of all, the Holocaust was a thing in and of itself, and the Holocaust overshadowed, I think, all other, correctly overshadowed, all other brutalities that were committed during the war. The other thing is we really needed Japan in a hurry. The government, you know, the Cold War, we wanted Japan on our side. MacArthur came in there and said, okay, the decision not to remove the emperor was a huge decision. It sent a message to everybody in Japan and throughout the world that this is over. If we had removed the emperor and tried him as a war criminal, remember everything that happened. I mean, it's been documented. The emperor knew about it. He didn't. It wasn't his idea, but he signed off on it. There was nothing kept from him. But the decision was made by the United States government through MacArthur to keep the emperor in power, because it felt a stable Japan was more important to the United States than a punished Japan. Is the bottom line, and. It was pure politics, and there was not a big public relations push in the United States to do otherwise. There was not a kind of a counterpart to the reaction to the Holocaust to push anything. There were very few war crimes trials in Japan, and what few there were that kind of went on endlessly, and nothing much came of it. And it was just an entirely different set of circumstances. And I think that if this to be fair to the Japanese, because they were not pushed to come to grips with what had happened immediately after the war, they made the decision, okay, forget it. We'll move on too. And the Germans were forced to come to grips with it by outside forces, and meaning the United States and the Allies, and the Japanese were not. And I'm not excusing what the Japanese did or did not do, and I'm just trying to explain it.
Well, Jim, we've reached the point in our program where we have time for just one last question, and that question is obligatory here in Silicon Valley. How will online news change journalism?
I have no idea. It is that is the great mystery. There are a lot of people betting a lot of money on a lot of answers to that question, and they're all different. I know great newspapers. In fact, the night newspapers have one whole answer. They're going to try to do the e-commerce way. In other words, you see an ad in one of their newspapers. You want to buy a product. You can do it through the newspaper. Online service. There are other newspapers say no. They're going to go another way. Everybody is trying to figure out what to do. I happen to believe that there's still going to be a need for gatekeepers, for people like me. They're going to be different kinds. They're probably not going to have on coats and ties, and they're going to probably be hundreds and thousands of them. But the technology that's all being developed right here in your backyard is making it possible for all of us, if we want to create our own newscast every night, tailored to our interests, and publish our own newspapers, tailored to our own interests. And where this is going to stop and how it's going to affect information and journalism, nobody knows. And if anybody ever answers that question and says they do know, tune them out.
Our thanks to Jim Lehrer, author of The Special Prisoner, James Risser, director of the Knight Fellowships Program at Stanford University, and David Kennedy, Pulitzer Prize author of Freedom from Fear, and, of course, to our audience here in San Jose and to those of you joining us on the radio. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley is adjourned.